stepped into the recording studio at the end of, very end of 1968, we had the songs written. We had been playing them a lot. It just sounded so good, and it felt good. It felt solid. What little audiences we had played to before we got to the studio, you know, playing at the Whiskey A Go Go in L.A., which was sort of a mecca. You know, we were sort of like the house band on Sundays and Mondays. And the reaction we were getting from, you know, people who were sort of in music, like Sunday nights, the Whiskey would be filled with whatever musicians were in town, whether it was, you know, Hendrix or the guys in the Buffalo Springfield or whatever. You know, that was who was in the audience, you know, with their girlfriends and their friends and the record company people and all that. We could see we were blowing them away just with the sheer intensity. We had some indication that it was happening. So, I mean, why not go into the studio and be confident? Hi, this is Robert Lamb of Chicago, in the studio for Chicago Transit Authority.
It was April 1969 when we first heard the unique blend of horn-driven rock and roll that was simply called Chicago Transit Authority. After that album, they would change the name of the band, but not their powerhouse sound. The music of Chicago in 1969 was on the cutting edge of rock and roll experimentation. They were unafraid to incorporate jazz into their sounds, to launch into freeform solos, to treat trumpets, trombones, and electric guitars with equal importance. There were other bands with similar ideas, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, for instance, but none of them came close to Chicago's commercial success, or certainly their longevity. Chicago Transit Authority was the first of 14 consecutive platinum albums for the band. During one stretch in the early 1970s, Chicago had 5 number one albums in a row. Even now, Chicago continues to be an amazing success story. And they've done it with no recognizable stars, focusing attention on the music instead of themselves. But on the eve of Chicago Transit Authority's release in April 1969, none of this was true. As I reminded Chicago founding keyboard player, singer, songwriter Robert Lamb with me in the studio.
Remember, we have AM radio, we have Top 40, and the progressive FM thing is just starting in. I mean, you can count them on one hand, mm-hmm. and have fingers left over. Mm-hmm. Horns were Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. The hippest horn was Hugh Masekela on So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star. And even that, the way it was played, was almost like a hyena-like laugh. It was almost facetious.
Yeah.
I mean, the horns were square.
They
horns
were.
Were marching band or big band. And yet, you guys seem to have absolutely no hesitation. There's a sense of confidence when you listen to the first CTA album that just is over everything. You didn't seem to be musically hesitant in the least. It's just your first album. You've never done this before.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. There was a certain confidence that the band had even going in there. And who knows what, you know, who knows what it was. I guess a lot of it had to do with the fact that we had done our homework in those clubs. You know, we had played Otis Redding's tunes so much, you know, and Sam and Dave and James Brown. And yeah, we even played some of Herb Alpert's tunes. You know.
Well, they were popular.
Yeah, they were popular.
We had to,
especially the first set. you know, we knew the work of the smaller jazz groups, you know, of the post-bop era, you know, Miles Davis, Gene Ammons, MJQ, just the guys around, Blue Mitchell, just the guys that we were listening to on the jazz stations in the 60s.
We're wish I could sing it to you. Words to say when I kiss you.
So I sing Beginnings. Beginnings is my Richie Havens influenced song. I'd gone to see Richie Havens play at the Old Ash Grove in L.A. right after we'd moved to Los Angeles. And, you know, I sat, like, right in front of him, and it was just him on acoustic guitar with another acoustic guitar playing behind him. And I thought, man, I wish I could play acoustic guitar. And so I went home and, you know, I taught myself a few open chords and wrote that song in the backyard of the Holly Drive House in Hollywood. Yeah. Beginnings is a love song, and it was, you know, aside from my interest in writing music, I'd been kind of interested in writing lyrics, and that was an exercise in seeing if I could write lyrics that didn't rhyme. So there aren't any lines in Beginnings that rhyme. It's kind of like an open poem. You know, we had our instruments were set up in a permanent, you know, in a permanent configuration in the living room of a small house. I mean, I can remember clearly sitting on a box in the backyard with a guitar that I barely could play because I'm a keyboardist, and, you know, writing Beginnings, you know, in the backyard of that house. I remember hearing Jimmy Panko working on what would be Make Me Smile and Color My World, you know, out in the dining room where we had a spinet set up. So everybody was working real hard, and you know, it was a real exciting time.
That's Robert Lamb. Many of the members of Chicago Transit Authority attended DePaul University, as did their producer and manager, Jim Guercio. Yet being college educated certainly isn't enough to explain why everything about this double album debut exudes brass, not just musically, but anatomically.
When we stepped into the recording studio at the very end of 1968, we had the songs written. We had been playing them a lot. It just sounded so good, and it felt good. It felt solid. What little audiences we had played to before we got to the studio, you know, playing at the Whiskey A Go-Go in L.A., which was sort of a mecca. You know, we were sort of like the house band on Sundays and Mondays. And the reaction we were getting from, you know, people who were sort of in music, like Sunday nights, the Whiskey would be filled with whatever musicians were in town, whether it was, you know, Hendrix or the guys in the Buffalo Springfield or whatever. You know, that was who was in the audience, you know, with their girlfriends and their friends and the record company people and all that. We could see we were blowing them away just with the sheer intensity. We had some indication that it was happening. So, I mean, why not go into the studio and be confident? Listen, which is kind of a band manifesto, or a lot the way Terry's introduction was. You know, listen, if you think that we're here for the money, you could be right. But the bread's not that good.
What a nugget, easily overlooked amidst the many more famous hits from the Chicago Transit Authority debut. That's Terry Kath singing Listen, with comments from Robert Lamb, who returns in a moment to explain how the band Chicago became a superstar band without any superstars. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can find more from Chicago at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Robert Lamb for the Chicago Transit Authority, Part 2.
Hi, this is Robert Lamb of Chicago, in the studio for Chicago Transit Authority.
Thanks, Robert. I'm Redbeard. I can't think of any band, American or otherwise, that's had greater success than the band Chicago with as anonymous a lineup. With that much talent at every position, no way that's an accident. Here's Robert Lamb of Chicago with me in the studio.
Somehow we knew that one of the things that could deter us is if one guy got in the limelight too much, or one guy started getting more attention, or one guy started getting the record company blowing in his ear real hard, or the industry in general, or, you know, all the stuff that we didn't know from any kind of experience, but we just had a hunch about it, that, you know, we could do this thing together better than if it dissipated into just a group of individuals, a group of personalities, a group of guys who were out for themselves.
Regarding how this complex, dynamic, big production was actually recorded on the CTA album, Robert Lamb startled me with another revelation.
Garcio was a real good producer, real good musician, and he had sort of a cinematic way of producing. You know, I mean, we cut this album on an 8-track. You know, this was everything was done on 8-track in these days.
You had like 7 guys in the band and 3 singers and background singers and wait a minute, that's
full drum kit.
That's at least we're talking at least 18, 24 mics, and you cut it on 8 tracks.
8-track, yeah.
So there.
Well, that was the state of the art in 1968, 69.
So is it a dumb question for saying, was there a lot of live in the studio and very little overdubbing on this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the vocals were overdubbed, and brass, you know, the way the brass got its, the way it sounds was doubled, but Garcio was a hell of a producer, you know, and he had studied, as every producer probably has done, has studied the way George Martin was doing the Beatles records, which was on 4 tracks. So it was, you just had to kind of plan it out so that, you know, the appropriate instruments would end up on the appropriate side together, you know, so that the tambourines wouldn't be over there with the guitars when they should be over here with, you know, whatever. We'll be right back.
Playing, I would have to describe it then as muscular. Could it have been the fact that, the electric guitar was one of the few things that really could compete to blast through and blow through the power mm-hmm. of the wall of horns mm-hmm. that you did?
Definitely. You know, muscular is a word that I've used
to
describe Terry's playing. You know. Because that's how pretty much he approached it. He approached the guitar. He, you know, his solos, he would play solos like, you know, he would start going someplace. Because, you know, this was like an era, like I say, when we played extended solos. He would start going someplace that, you know, I'd be comping and listening and thinking, you know, there's no way he's ever going to get out of this. And he would muscle his way through it. You know, he would find a way out of it. He would, you know, he would kick the door down to find out how to get someplace. And we only had one guitar player, and you know, we didn't have anybody playing rhythm. He played rhythm and lead sometimes simultaneously, but the nature of his rhythms would just propel the band. And I've yet to come across a rhythm player who could play with his intensity, with his rhythmic sharpness. I mean, he was really on the money time-wise. He just kicked it. He just really kicked it. He never got tired. You know, he was like built like a football player, you know, and he just never got tired. He was strong, just strong. A lot of nights I'd come off stage and, you know, there'd be blood all over his guitar. That's
what?
How there'd be blood on his guitar.
From what?
From, you know, yeah, from strumming.
Fingers against steel string?
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah. So he was pretty intense about it.
Thank you.
you know, with songs Questions 67 and 68 and Poem 58, even Chicago Transit Authority song titles were unconventional, like Lawrence Ferlinghetti's poetry. Again, Robert Lamb.
All that stuff was definitely being filtered in the culture, you know. I mean, Rolling Stone magazine had just started, the LA Free Press, you know, was an important part of the literature in those days. And guys like Ferlinghetti were probably at the top of their game. So all that stuff, it was all part of that culture, you know. There we were.
Poem 58, spotlighting that Roman candle of musical talent in singing, songwriting, and guitar playing from Terry Kath. Next, we'll find out how that was all tragically lost. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can find more from Robert Lamb and the Chicago Story at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Robert Lamb for the Chicago Transit Authority, Part 2.
Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Robert Lamb of Chicago with Redbeard.
Thank you, Robert. There would actually develop a keen race between Al Kooper's New York-based Blood, Sweat, and Tears and the by-now West Coast-based Chicago band to see which one would capture the public's imagination for horn-driven, big band, ensemble rock music. The conventional wisdom was that there was only room for one such band to survive long-term. After a brilliant debut in 1968, Al Kooper left Blood, Sweat, and Tears, eventually signing and producing an unknown band from Jacksonville, Florida, with the funny name of Lynyrd Skynyrd. Blood, Sweat, and Tears had great success as a pop vocal band for a few years, but soon disbanded. Chicago, on the other hand, became a dynasty. The CTA album launched a dizzying series of 120 million in sales and still climbing. The Chicago Transit Authority album was the first of four double albums in a row to go multi-platinum. Chicago 5, a single disc, followed suit. But even after 11 albums, on January 23, 1978, a freak accident that is still grossly misreported, even by otherwise reputable sources, took the life of Chicago guitarist, singer, songwriter Terry Kath, and with it, one of music's brightest talents. Here again is Robert Lamb of Chicago.
We lost Terry the beginning of 1978. We had just completed a very successful 1977 tour. We had done a world tour and then gone back and sort of done another half a world tour, you know, a world and a half tour, and. Everybody was pretty burned and, very tired. And Jimmy Guercio, If You Leave Me Now had been like the biggest song we'd ever done. It was like number one in every country from A to Z. And, and so we went and played in all those places. But Jimmy Guercio, something happened with Jimmy Guercio and I to this day don't know exactly what it was, you know, it was something physiological. But the upshot of it was that we fired him. You know, we fired him. The relationship had gone completely south. And so there was a lot of disarray. There was a lot of discord. There was a lot of confusion, fear, anxiety, individually and collectively. It was suddenly very scary in one sense to be without him. It was a bit of a lynch mob dynamic going on in our band in regards to him that I think was, you know, probably unjustified. You know, I think that plays a role in what happened to Terry. Now, Terry had always been a sportsman, an outdoorsman, you know, a collector and aficionado of guns and motorcycles and cars, you know. And he was, we were sort of still in this turmoil, and he was, he wasn't feeling real good. And the story that I've heard from one of my keyboard tech, who was sharing a house with Terry, was that Terry had come over to the house to play for a while. He had a complete, you know, guitar rig set up, and he would just come over there and just play whenever he felt like, and he would leave. And he had just finished playing. He was feeling actually pretty good that day, and they were just sitting across from each other in the living room, and he had an automatic gun. Now, I have read that he was playing Russian roulette. Well, you don't play Russian roulette with an automatic weapon because it doesn't work. You know, it doesn't spin. Apparently, he had been cleaning the gun, and the cartridge was empty, but he had forgotten that there was a round chambered, and he just was sort of toying with the gun, had the gun in his hand, and pulled the trigger and hit himself squarely in the side of the head from like an angle that was sort of down near his side rather than, you know, right at his temple. So, you know, I'm convinced that you know, it was accidental. And, you know, all the stories that I've heard about being suicide or being Russian roulette, I know are not true. You know, I was just about ready to go out to dinner. I think it was my wedding anniversary night, as a matter of fact. I was getting ready to go out to dinner, and I got a call from the band's attorney, Ken Kleinberg. And, you know, he told me what had happened, and he asked me to go out to Malibu, where Terry was living with his wife and baby daughter. And Ken Kleinberg asked me to get out there real fast and, you know, just kind of be with her for when she got notification, you know, just to kind of be there to support her. But the police had beat me there, but I got there at the same time as Terry's parents, so I had to break the news to his parents. I hated it. I hated it.
Sleepless hours and dreamless nights and faraways.
Ooh, wishing you were, wishing you were here.
Heaven knows and Lord it shows when I'm away.
Thank you.
sung by the late Terry Kath. That's Chicago from Chicago 7 with Wishing You Were Here, with the Beach Boys on those haunting harmonies. You may be shocked to find that Robert Lamb actually voted to change the name of the band after Terry Kath's 1978 accidental death, about 80 million album sales ago, risking all of that phenomenal success for the band members as well as himself and their families.
Yeah, I'm kind of a hardliner about it in that I've always felt that, you know, the band forever changed from being Chicago, you know. I mean, even after the initial period of grief over loss had passed, I felt strongly that really we ought to just change the name of the band because it's not the same band. Pretty radical. And, you know, it's not a real rational thing to do because, you know, we're talking about the careers of six other people and the security of their families and commitments to the record company and a public which, you know, loves the music and the band. So, you know, the decision was made to go on and, you know, so there's still a Chicago today. But in my mind, the chemistry was gone when Terry died. What is left, the name of the band, the surviving members, and some new members, you know, building upon the beginning, you know, the first 11 albums. For me, it doesn't have the same cohesiveness, urgency, depth without Terry. It's got different depth.
That's the final word from Robert Lamb, Chicago Transit Authority's debut. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Robert Lamb of Chicago. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2014, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can find all your favorites when you visit inthestudio.net.